At This Is the City, we strive to provide the story of downtown Los Angeles for all of our listeners, but we can't do it without you. If you enjoy our work, please consider donating on our website. It's easy to do via PayPal, and it helps us cover the costs of producing the show. You can also help others discover the show by sharing us on social media or leaving us a review in iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.
From downtown Los Angeles, This Is the City, a podcast focusing on the politics, art, and culture of Los Angeles. I'm your host, Garen Kelsaw. This week, we're dedicated to the election. We're going to take a more macro look and talk about some of California's more tricky propositions. My guests, Michael Pfeffer and Anthony Bejarano, will discuss. And later, we'll just do a quick overview of some of the localized Los Angeles City options on the ballot. Let's get right into it. This is the City. I'm Garen Kelsaw. We're in an election special this episode, and it's fantastic to grab some people on the phone to discuss the major propositions facing California this Tuesday. So joining me, I have Anthony Bejarano, a government lawyer who specializes in labor and employment. He's a former elected official for the city of Baldwin Park and has also been the director of the Southern California Regional Rail Authority. How are you, Anthony?
Very good. Thank you, Garen.
And also we have Michael Pfeffer, who is an attorney at law, also an adjunct professor at Trinity University, specializing in constitutional law. Right, Michael?
That's right.
Fantastic. So thank you, gentlemen, both for joining me. I very much try to focus on elections and civic duty every time we have the opportunity on this show. So obviously this is a historic year. Can we just start and talk about overall, what are your first takes, thoughts as we kind of round down election 2016? Go ahead, Michael.
Sure. A couple of things. First of all, I've been voting since 1980, and I've never seen such garbage as I've seen from both sides of the aisle here. And it really is discouraging, to be quite honest with you. And I believe that it doesn't speak well for our ability to self-govern when it kind of boils down to what we've been having here. I'm greatly discouraged about that, I will say. With respect to these propositions, not specifically, but in general, I'm not a big proposition guy. I think propositions let the legislators off the hook. We elected them to do the hard stuff and the easy stuff. And I have a tough time with this many propositions and so many of them written by special interest, intending to take cash out of the people's pocket and put it in their own.
How about you, Anthony? What are your thoughts?
You know, it's amazing. Mr. Pfeffer and I are on, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum politically, but we are in full agreement on the sort of general tenor of the election. First, to see longstanding institutions called into question by presidential candidates and to have those institutions weighing in on the election is just wild for me. I agree with Mr. Pfeffer, especially on the ballot initiatives and the breadth of them and the number of them. I tried really hard to push through the legislature an actual amendment to change the ballot initiative that would have made it more effective. I think one requiring the elected officials up there in Sacramento to first take a pass at drafting legislation for anything that qualifies for the ballot before it can go on the ballot. And then limiting the number of initiatives that can ever get on the ballot for every election cycle, just because statistically people don't know what they're voting on, and they vote no as a matter of course just because they're so upset at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think as an observer, an active participant, talking to a lot of people dealing with the proposition on the ballot this year, especially very smart, very educated people are like, this is just way too much. The time investment, the questions that are being asked, it literally, I think, Michael, you touched on it perfectly. I thought this is what we hired legislators to do, right? Isn't this their job? But that being said, the pie is baked, the ballot is made, it is what it is. So we should dive in and start talking about some of the issues that are facing us. One of them, in a large way, curtails with a proposition we had the last election cycle, Proposition 47, and it's 57 this time that people are debating. So Proposition 57 deals with parole for nonviolent criminals and juvenile court trials. It's interesting to me that these two concepts are actually baked into the same proposition. But essentially what we would do here is increase parole and good behavior opportunities for felons who were convicted of what are considered nonviolent crimes. And it would also allow judges, not prosecutors, to determine when a juvenile will be tried as an adult. So, Anthony, what are your initial thoughts on the proposition?
So, deep dive on Prop 57 is that there's a lot of things justice-wise that are being tackled. They created a lot of policy points to be considered, but also deep politics issues. People are very unhappy with Prop 47 as they, I think, improperly attribute the rise in crime to those people that were released under 47. But, you know, when I wasn't elected, I would always approach votes on a sort of a three-tier basis. One, what is the problem that we're trying to solve? Two, what does this particular action do to solve that problem? And then three, how much would it cost? I think only the first two are really implicated. Regardless of what you think about the policy issues that are addressed in 57, the problem that it's trying to get at is the Supreme Court's ruling that California prisons were considered cruel and unusual punishment because of their overcrowding. And due to the nature of enhancements in California, which are these ways to stack up sentences for people who are convicted of a crime, even if it's one crime, they can have four different enhancements that would make a crime that was 5 years turn into 15 or 20. So that's contributed to our overcrowding of the prison. Supreme Court says we got to let people out, and we're past our deadline and we're still overcrowded. So I would rather have these people go to a parole board and have someone evaluate them on a case-by-case basis and let them out than have the Supreme Court say 20,000 need to be released immediately. So that's my take.
Yeah, definitely a point that I think gets left out of the conversation sometimes when these conversations are had is that California is under court order to deal with its population. Michael, what are your take?
Well, I think that 47 was ill-conceived as well as 57. I get it. We are overcrowded. And I also think that there's been twice now that courts have, we've been under court order to reduce the population, and we did so. We did reduce the population. We're not currently under a direct court order to reduce the population sooner. And admittedly, we are in a place where, yes, the courts could come down and say to us once again to release prisoners. This is a poorly drafted law. It doesn't define what nonviolent felon really means. I think it's unnecessary to join this issue of trying minors for really bad crimes for trying them as an adult. I don't know why that has to be tied here. I just think this law, though maybe laudable purposes, it's just not written well enough to make it do what it's intended to do.
Yeah, and that's part of what I think is interesting about our proposition system is that you get to see how bills get baked in with very disparate questions sometimes that you have to ask and approve, and you get some sometimes unintended consequences therein. So there should be a point kind of made. The text of the proposition does use existing California Penal Code to define what those crimes are, which is actually one of the arguments that the opponents of the proposition are using, is that some crimes that are not specifically defined as violent within that Penal Code section strike everyday humans as that's an extremely violent crime. So it is an ongoing kind of question there. So with Prop 57 overall, Anthony says he's going forward. Michael says he's going against. It's a deep dive, I think everybody kind of has to take, but we're going to move on to 61. And under Prop 61, we're dealing with prescription drugs, healthcare prices. This is one that's interestingly, former Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has seemed to taken a hold of and wanted to. He's actually holding rally in Los Angeles on Monday at Pershing Square in support of 61. Michael, have you had a chance to look at this one? What are your kind of thoughts?
I have, Garen. I mean, here we have this. First of all, I think that I got to say that I'm maybe outright that I'm not a supporter of Obamacare. And I think that's part of the sort of foundation of 61. And I think that the attempt to fix prices at this level to be consistent with the level of the Veterans Administration is not going to work. It's going to either increase prices on everybody, on the Veterans Administration, which is not good for them, and it's going to increase prices for the people that aren't treated, aren't addressed by this bill. It's pretty much government employees that are going to be affected by this. And I think the net result is we're going to have higher prices. I just don't think that this is the answer to this problem of high medication prices, which of course does exist.
So, I'm going to break from my usual, what is the problem? How does this try to solve it? Because I don't think that really gets to the issue of this particular proposition. I look at Prop 61 much like a smaller union joining with a bunch of other unions to negotiate their wages across employers. So our drug prices have been rising for some time now. We have some of the highest drug prices in the world. The drug companies spend a ton of money to lobby Congress. There's no solution to this increasing cost that is, in a lot of ways, hampering our economic growth. As a country, there's no sort of solution in sight. And so I see this as a gamble for sure. There's the possibility that there could be unintended consequences. But, California is a big state. The people that the prices that would be, sort of stuck to the veterans' lower prices, the VA's lower prices, is a sizable enough amount of people that it would be a good voting block in terms of sending a message to Big Pharma. And, if they try to raise the prices on everybody else, then maybe there'll be an uproar and we can figure out a way to solve this problem the right way. But we got to do something, in my opinion, because doing nothing is not working.
And that's definitely part of it. And I want to kind of unpack what we just discussed in a couple of ways. So interesting that you feel, Anthony, this is like unions coming together, because one of the things I do with all these propositions is kind of see who's for them and who's against them, because that can sometimes inform the overall conversation. And interestingly enough, there are a lot of unions who are against 61 officially out at the IBW, United Roofers, United Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, a lot of different sections of the organizations that are coming out against this one. And it is a larger question, I think, that Michael touched on about Obamacare and how we approach the tools and mechanisms that are supposed to work in our healthcare. So, in your view, Michael, what are some better steps to approach? What could we look at down the pipe or actually put on our legislators as something that would help fight and reduce these prices?
Well, we could put on our legislature in some ways, I can kind of see what Mr. Bejarano is talking about here, because, hey, look, yeah, there is strength in unifying. But I think our legislatures could do that by creating a competitive market whereby the price is not fixed artificially. It's fixed by negotiation. And that's not what happens here. Here we have this scheme to lower prices on one segment, and then hopefully it'll spin down to everybody else. I just don't think that's going to work here. And I think that the best thing to do is create a more competitive market that the legislatures could do, and through wise legislation and actually tackle this problem for everybody.
So Anthony, what do you think? I mean, obviously, we know the VA is one of the largest buyers of drugs, which is why it's pinned to this group in the proposition itself. But also, we see that reflecting in Medicare prices across the country, this kind of broad buying power helping control prices. So what do you think?
I think that's the way to tackle the problem. I don't have a lot of faith in my legislators to handle this problem because they, one, haven't, and two, again, like I said, Big Pharma spends a ton of money to lobby them. So I think there needs to be a sort of backdoor. If more states had extended Medicare, like California did, perhaps the premiums for Obamacare would be lower. And if other states came along with us and said, look, we're not paying more than this amount for your drugs, it might have a negative impact on the market, but also, you know, there's a lot of businesses that will take on a lower payment for a service to a government because of the volume of business they get. So yes, they're getting lower on the unit price, but they get so much volume that they just make the deal. Legal practices like that, government lawyers, firms that represent public agencies, their rates are sometimes a half or a third of what your regular law firm is. But they do it because, one, it's a public service, and two, they can get steady volume of work because someone's always suing the city. If you have Medi-Cal, you know, as your biggest customer, you're going to have a ton of customers. There's always going to be people there. So what you're losing on the individual price, you're making on the larger market share.
Excellent conversation, gentlemen. And again, I thank you both for joining us. I appreciate your time. And I think this is really great just to normalize having these conversations, right? I think that's part of voter engagement and voter activity, that like we are being civil. You guys aren't being punks to each other, so to speak. And we can move forward and find better solutions that way. And I just want to point that out. And we'll have much more of this conversation after these messages. Eat Drink Podcast is a great way to get new ideas on what to explore downtown. Check out this quick preview to whet your appetite. Welcome to Eat Drink Podcast. I'm your host, Garen Kelsaw, along with
Anthony Bejarano.
I'm just ready to get my chopsticks in the zone.
And we're here at Peking Tavern, which is your amazing restaurant and bar.
That's right.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. I love this place, by the way.
We always call this the $10,000 dumpling.
That's right.
Because we actually won $10,000 on a television show.
Guys, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I really feel like I can see you two young guys hanging out in Beijing, getting tore up, and now we're gonna do the same thing. Cheers!
First Sundays is DTLA's Community Brunch, a gathering of friends, residents, stakeholders for overall good times. So come with your old friends and meet some new ones. We do it the first Sunday of every month, and for November, we're at Brew & Proper, 840 South Spring Street in downtown LA from 12 to 4. And now more from my conversation with Anthony and Michael. Pivot to what I think is a huge question that came up in the propositions. It's Proposition 62. It's about the death penalty. And there's actually two death penalty related propositions on the ballot this time. It's 62 and 66. And 66 is more procedural. 62 is straight up. The question is, do we repeal the death penalty and make life without the possibility of parole the maximum punishment for murder in the state of California? Anthony, weigh in, man. This is a big question for a lot of people. It touches a lot of different nerves and emotions. What are your thoughts?
Well, first, I just want to say that this is the type of thing that should be an initiative that you put to the people. It's straightforward. It's a huge, like, overarching policy as opposed to like nuance regulation and legislation. Should we have the death penalty or not? That's the kind of stuff that should be on the ballot every election, real basic stuff. The death penalty doesn't work. There's a lot of data out there that shows that it's actually not that much of a deterrent. Number one. Number two, I think philosophically, if we are executing people as a government, it makes it very difficult to make the case that, you know, killing people is wrong. And even if it is punishment, I think we're focusing on punishment versus rehabilitation. And people like Foucault and other philosophers that have studied prison for time immemorial, you know, punishment doesn't work. Rehabilitation works much better. It's overly expensive. And, you know, the number of times that we've executed people who are exonerated later in life, I think it's just better to get rid of the death penalty and move forward as a civilized society and not some barbaric kind of community where we, you know, string people up by the horse and drag them around or whatever.
Well, you mean you had to paint the extra picture there, Anthony, but point well taken. There are those that definitely argue it's barbaric, especially not necessarily in California where our procedures are different, but we all know the situations in other states because European companies who make the particular drug cocktail that America has been using have refused to let those drugs be used in executions. And so there are larger questions about the brutality of it. Michael, what's your take on this big moral question, so to speak, for the people of the state of California?
Yeah, first of all, I agree with Mr. Bejarano. This is the kind of thing that should be decided by proposition. It is, it's an up or down moral and philosophical discussion that quite frankly, I think it's about time that we had something like this, an up or down vote on this. I am a supporter of the death penalty, not as a deterrent, but as a punishment. I believe that there are some crimes so heinous and that the people actually forfeit their right to live among us. And I don't believe that it should be just willy-nilly death penalty, but I believe that the answer is to fix the problem, which I think actually, by the way, 66 goes in some direction toward it. But I am in favor of the death penalty. The one sure thing is that if somebody commits a heinous crime, which I will not enumerate, but if someone commits a heinous crime, they won't do it again after they've been subjected to the death penalty.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, death is definitely the final straw there. But do you have reservations at all, Michael, about some of the points that Anthony made? Obviously, the disparities being shown in the criminal justice system, the principle, so to speak, or philosophical question of if it's worth killing one innocent to kill 10 guilties. What's your take on that part of it?
Yeah, I tell you, I have not seen any hard and fast evidence of being people being executed and being later found to be not guilty. Does the court system make mistakes? Yeah, heck yeah. I mean, I've seen them make mistakes over and over again, and in our society make mistakes. I think there's huge problems with the way that our justice system runs in general, generally speaking. But I have this sense that there are things which you forfeit your life. Yes, it is. It's a difficult thing to do. It's a difficult thing as a society to do. But frankly, I think we've messed with it so much that it's becoming even worse than it would have been to have someone stand up before the firing squad.
Yes, definitely. It's part of that being human in a democracy and plaguing ourselves with these tough questions. Obviously, you know, a lot of us have experienced the type of crime and violence where these questions come up. And so it does, like I said, touch very close to home for a lot of us and what we consider. So I want to move forward and discuss one of the giggle propositions, so to speak, marijuana legalization. And I say that as a stoner pun. Sorry, guys. I just couldn't resist. I'm just going to put that out there. But really, it is a question about the adult use of recreational marijuana. We've seen this pass in other states, even though California was one of the first to have a medical provision on the ballot, also that came about via the proposition process. SB 420, I believe it ended up being called after it was tailored. But here we are now with the question of the adult use of marijuana, its dangers compared to alcohol. And again, this is one that kind of gets into the weeds. This proposition has a lot of... Oh, wait, was that a... Yeah, all right, sorry. This proposition has a lot of different facets. So, Michael, what's your initial take? Have you done the deep dive on this one?
I have. I spent a lot of time with marijuana in my late teens and early adult life, and various other adjunct type of... pursuits. I am not someone who thinks, oh my gosh, if you do the marijuana, you know, the sort of reefer madness kind of thing where you're going to be, you know, out killing and thieving. And, but I'll tell you, the statistics that are coming out of Colorado are not all that promising in terms of what is happening. My understanding, and I will say I have not smoked marijuana for, you know, 3 decades at least, and but I understand that it is this product has become a very mind-altering product, even more so than it ever was, and I think it's created some problems. There's issues of enforcement for driving issues. There's an issue of unintended consequences with the people, young people getting the marijuana. Admittedly, they get a hold of it now, I suspect. But I am a person who thinks that when you make a law like this, the government is tacitly saying, we agree with marijuana usage. And that's not a message that I want to send. So I oppose Proposition 64.
And, you know, I look at the history of the illegality of marijuana and the admissions out of the Nixon administration about how we needed to get rid of the hippies and the blacks. And so that's why we criminalized it. And that's why we did the war on drugs. And so it makes me think that, like, the illegal, making marijuana illegal in the first place was kind of suspect. Ultimately, we need to be studying the effects of marijuana on the human brain, what it does to our bodies, both bad and good. And the way to get there is to take it off the schedule that it is for the federal government so that we can actually study it. And the way to push that to happen is, you know, as California goes the nation. So we legalize it, we figure out a way to tax it, regulate it, it'd be far better than the black market that exists now if it's regulated in dosage and all these different things and we can study it. So I'm voting yes on it. It's a weird initiative. There's a lot baked into it. But I think it's straightforward in terms of it'll now be legal in California and we can just move forward to understanding it. And just like tobacco, right? Tobacco is legal, but the use of tobacco has significantly dropped in California over the last 10 years, in part because of information that it's really bad for you. And in part because knowing that it's bad for you, we tax it.
Well, so, I mean, Anthony, I definitely understand why you say that California, so goes the nation. But do you feel like that's a little bit of maybe putting the cart before the horse, so to speak? Should it get that research, get descheduled by the FDA and the DEA before that happens?
I don't see marijuana as that dangerous of a substance that we require that sort of care. It's been around for a long time. You know, many a generation has dabbled. And at this juncture, there's no reason to think that it's any more dangerous than alcohol.
And to you, Michael, you know, we talked about the tacit consent of the government. What do you think about that with alcohol? I mean, we went through prohibition, obviously not you or I, but the country did. And now we know that alcohol is a big dangerous substance in a lot of ways, be it vehicular accidents, violence that ensues from people who are drunk, or just alcoholism itself. What do you think about that kind of overlap? Do you feel like, for instance, marijuana is more dangerous than alcohol?
More dangerous. First of all, I think that I'm not a teetotaler, but I got maybe my bias is that I'm not a person who likes to have anything controlling me from the outside, except for my will inside. So I don't really do things that create me to be under the influence, if you will, of something else. But I'll say this, that yes, the alcohol is an issue, and it's got a lot of societal problems, alcoholism and things of that nature. But it is something that has been, in time immemorial, it has been a part of our culture, our civilization. And I think that we're at the point where that's not going to create anything new in terms of society's feelings towards it. On the other hand, marijuana, right or wrong, and I tend to agree, maybe it certainly shouldn't have been made illegal for the reasons that Mr. Bejarano points out, and I'm not disputing that it was, but I will say this, I it was a part of my life for a lot of years, and those were not particularly healthy, good years for me in my life. It delayed my educational process, it delayed a lot of things that I wish didn't happen. But I think that society, this is not working where it's being tried. And to add another thing to worry about besides alcohol is wrongheaded, in my opinion.
And to you, Mr. Bejarano, it seems like if you listen to the rumblings on the street, not just the existing kind of marijuana providers for the medicinal markets, but also some of the more, third party independents that California is known to have are very against this as a big business giveaway, as far as the licensing and transportation goes of marijuana and creating a bureaucracy around marijuana. Do you think 64 is better than what we have now?
Yeah, I definitely think so. It's completely unregulated, right? Like, there's just not any kind of look into what's being offered, what's being sold, what's being sprayed on the plant. They're, the guys up in the hills are diverting water. I mean, it's the black market of it, or the gray market is creating havoc. And, we might lose some things because of overregulation, and it might become like, Monsanto or whatever, but I think it's the chance we got to take.
Fair enough. And that's going to be our run through the major propositional questions here. Obviously, the ballot is extensive, so we encourage everyone to do their homework. But I would be remiss if I let you gentlemen go without touching on the most amazing, incredulous, crazy presidential race I've seen in my entire lifetime. So now we're at a point where the polls are pretty showing, within the margin of error. I think Clinton's at 2.8, according to Real Clear Politics now. Bejarano, where are we at? What's going on? What happened? What can happen? We're in the home stretch.
This has been so insane. It's really difficult to even make a call in terms of where we go from here. I would like to make a bold prediction. I think Florida's going blue, and I think it's going to go blue by more votes than people think. And I think we're going to find out after the fact that a big portion of why that happened has to do with the exodus from the island of Puerto Rico to Florida. So you have, a couple hundred thousand people since 2012 that have relocated from Puerto Rico to Florida, who lean Democrat, who are upset with the GOP for letting Puerto Rico sort of languish out there, and who frankly have never been able to vote in a presidential election. So I think that those people are not captured by polls, and that Florida's going to go blue. I hope that as a nation, we can come together and figure out like how to heal from this divisive and ugly election. I hope the Republicans do not
keep their promise to immediately try to impeach Hillary and refuse to appoint justices to the Supreme Court. I mean, we got to get back to some basic civility and start getting stuff done. I don't think we're as in terrible shape as Mr. Trump likes to say. You know, I think our GDP has continued to grow as a nation over the last 100 or years or so. There's less violence in America than now than ever before in our history. We're involved in less wars than, you know, we have been in a while. So I think we're doing okay, but we do have some serious problems we need to address. And in order to do that, we need to work together to get it done.
So that being said, you know, you're with her. You're voting for Hillary. You're 100% on board.
I'm 100% on board voting for Hillary. There's just no other choice. I would never hire a veterinarian to do heart surgery on me. Trump has no experience in government at all. And if you've ever worked in government, you know it's a different kind of thing and you have to have some experience. And he doesn't care about anybody but Trump. He's demonstrated that in his whole life. Say what you will about Hillary, she's at least been a public servant.
And so you, Michael, I mean, not to be presumptive, but I imagine you're a California Republican. You know, what is your take overall? I mean, you're in a unique position being in California and being a conservative. But what's your view overall on how this is all shaken out? And are you a Trump guy?
Yeah, here's where I'm at. I am a Republican. I am rather disgusted at the GOP for the situation we find ourselves in. I think that we have a legislative class on both sides of the aisle that are not thinking about the people's interests. And I think that Trump is an outgrowth of that dissatisfaction with government. I know as a conservative, we have really no conservative voice or very little conservative legislative voice, notwithstanding the fact that the GOP controls both houses. And that's difficult. That's difficult to stomach. And I think that's the reaction of the GOP nominating someone like Donald Trump, who I'm not a fan of the man. I do not follow his way of dealing with life. I do not follow. The thing that really hurts me about him that makes me mad is that, you know what? We learn how to control our voices early on in life. We learn how to control what we say out of our mouth. In jest or not, it really hurts the impression people have of us, and that's his problem. He does not know when or how to shut up. That being said, I find Hillary's level of corruption, and for whatever reason, we have been given this picture of what her and the Democratic Party around her have done vis-a-vis these WikiLeaks. And I've become a one issue a voter here. I am a voter for the chance, just the chance that Trump might appoint people to the Supreme Court that have a constitutionalist background and not the background that we currently have. So I'm going to vote for Trump.
Fair enough. I mean, I, like I said, understand that you're in a unique position, and I think you pointed to some great illuminating points about the larger overall questions of the GOP, you know, with having the majorities in both houses of Congress, but yet still seeming to stall out. Do you think if Hillary becomes president, do you think that will change? You know, like say the GOP retains control of both houses, Hillary's president, are we still facing 4 to 8 years of gridlock?
I'd say it's more than likely. I will say this about gridlock. I believe the framers created gridlock. I do not believe that government was meant to be efficient. I do not believe that the federal government was meant to be able to make laws quickly. I believe the framers created gridlock. That being said, as far as I'm concerned, the Republicans that run the House and the Senate have done nothing, period. And so I know some might say, well, yeah, because that's because they wanted to just bring Obama down and tear apart his administration. Obama has basically said, I don't give a crud what you guys say. I'm going to do what I want anyway. So, hey, if to that extent, to the extent one agrees with his principles, he's done a great job. But in my book, I think that it's broken. And I'm a citizen legislator type of a person. I don't really think as long as you bring in good people around you, that you need someone with a lot of government experience to do that office. And maybe this will be a time when either way, I think the Republican Congress will lose power, and that's why they're against Trump.
But to you, Anthony, what do you think of the overall question? Did the framers create gridlock? Are we talking about gridlock or standstill? We're at 8 Supreme Court justices. Hillary wins. There's certain senators who are saying, this is how it is, guys. Like, suck it up. Like, what are your thoughts?
They definitely built into the system gridlock. It forces compromise. They were very fearful of fast moving government. All of that is true. That being said, what we've seen is very unprecedented. To not approve a Supreme Court justice, essentially leaving the Supreme Court as like a third nipple, like every vote is almost always going to come down 4-4. A few have not, but still, like, essentially we've been deprived of the Supreme Court that, the Congress has already threatened before she's even, first of all, they said before the election, we're going to let the election decide because the American people deserve to get to choose the person that chooses the Supreme Court justices. And now all of a sudden it looks like they're going to lose. They're going back on that. Like, it's preposterous. Like, you have one job as a senator vis-a-vis the Supreme Court, and that's to advise and consent, not to, withhold your consent unreasonably, refuse to hold hearings, refuse to even talk about potential justice. Like, that's just absurd. It's a complete abdication of their duties. I'm very disappointed. This is not my granddaddy's Republican Party kind of thing, where, as much as they disagreed on policy, stuff got done. It's become very personal. It's become very petty. The fact that the Republicans at the inauguration of Barack Obama agreed to not pass anything, no matter what it was, I think is terrible politics and terrible policy.
And to you, Michael, you mentioned earlier in your reasoning for Trump, you're a single issue voter. You're thinking about the Supreme Court. Obviously, we're looking at possibly three positions to be filled there. But you also mentioned that Trump seems to be someone who doesn't know how to control his mouth. And we know on the national and world stage how very literally dangerous that can be. Does that not cause you any reservation in that vote?
It certainly causes me reservation. I'm not a fool. I understand that this man is dangerous. I'm just not all that impressed by Hillary's foreign policy behaviors either. But yes, I have some reservations towards Trump being able to control his mouth. I think that it could portend real trouble. And so, yes, it's not a decision I've made lightly. I've gone back and forth between not for voting for Hillary, but between not voting for Trump. But I decided that in California, it's kind of, you said, a unique place. We're not going to have anything to do with the determination of who the eventual president is if you're a Republican. So whatever. But I'm going to vote my conscience.
I would just say, Pef, it's not just that he can't control his words, like he can be a jerk and say mean things. There's a long history of him being vindictive and petty and holding grudges and trying to even scores. So it's more than just he, runs his mouth a little bit, which I've been accused of before.
Yeah, and I get that. I really do get that. But some of these things that we've seen on WikiLeaks, speak about Bernie Sanders, man, that guy got screwed. He got totally hosed. And I'm sorry. that's probably not as professional as I would want to be, but it just seems like this has become politics has become a blood sport. And so I don't know. I hear you. Anthony, I cannot disagree with that some of that characterization. It's just, we are in this place where we're going to choose one or the other. And, you know, I'm just going to hold my nose and choose Donald Trump.
And on that note, we're going to leave it right there. Gentlemen, I must say thank you again. This has been a fantastic conversation that we absolutely must do again. And I'd be willing to put beer there next time, or a 64 passes, maybe something else. I don't know. I'm just kidding. Michael Pfeffer is an adjunct professor at Trinity University, specializing in constitutional law. He's also an attorney at law in the South, in Orange County, excuse me. And Anthony Bejarano is a government lawyer and former elected official for the city of Baldwin Park. Gentlemen, thank you again so much for joining me.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Pfeffer.
Needless to say, we weren't able to cover all of the California propositions in our discussion, so we encourage you all to continue the research and work to prepare yourselves for the election Tuesday. However, we wanted to touch on some questions that face Angelenos specifically, like Measure HHH, which deals with Los Angeles' burgeoning homelessness problem. A yes vote would issue $1.2 billion in bonds to help fund housing for homeless people and people at risk of becoming homeless, as well as mental health care, addiction treatment, and other services. Measure JJJ, which is an answer to the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative we've talked about on this program before, and yes vote here would impose minimum affordable housing requirements, training standards, labor and wage regulations on development problems requiring zoning changes. This is one of the many forms of zoning reform that Angelenos and different groups of Angelenos are trying to move forward. Also, a standout question, Measure M, the extension of an additional 0.5% sales tax for transportation to be extended indefinitely instead of sunsetting in 2039. Now, Metro is 100% behind this. This is very much where they're looking to get a lot of funding for expanding the projects that they're already in and want to do in the future. And we think that this is an important question for Angelenos moving forward. That's going to do it for us this week. Join us next time on This is the City for more of the politics, art, and culture that make Los Angeles. This is the City is written and produced by me, Garen Kelsall, and my partner, Jonas Sosnowski. Our theme music is by Taj Simmons. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. We're on Twitter at This is the City LA or on Facebook at facebook.com/thisisthecity. Send us a message or leave a comment. Let us know what you think and what you want to hear on upcoming episodes. Until next time, be well.